You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, Brain Hackers. Dave Farrow here with another Brains Behind It. I'm talking today with Zahir Doza. He's the founder of and CEO of Function of Beauty. Now, this is getting into the hyper-personalized, personal, customized world that new technology allows us to have. I literally have a businessman here who is making, I guess, artisanal shampoo. Is that the best way to say it? I mean, artisanal soap. You're making essentially shampoos and conditioners that are specifically formulated to different people's scalps, right?
Correct, correct. So we would probably go with like bespoke or customized just because I think artisanal...
implies small, and you guys want to be big, right?
Not only for the size, just I think artisanal has a concept behind it where it's purely art-based or creative-based versus... We have
scientific
and science that goes into it. So yeah.
Ah, okay. Okay. So, is that the sum total of what you do, or you have a multi, is that one part of what you do?
That is the sum total of what I do is do personalized beauty products. So the idea is, how do we transform the beauty industry to make it personalized?
Is this really expensive? Is this only for celebrities, or would this?
No. We've tried to bring down our costs as much as we can. So we eliminated all middlemen. We're completely vertically integrated. So while we use very expensive ingredients, we're able to basically pass on the cost savings of not having all these different distributors and retailers directly to our customers. So it's
okay. So it's just like I would go on. I go onto the website. I put in my personal information. Do I have some sort of test? Like, do I put a pH strip on my head or something like that? Is there?
So we do the pH testing on our end just to make sure we're not going to hair fall. But you would end up doing a hair quiz. So you tell us what your hair profile.
I take a little like snippet and send it to you in the mail or something.
Only men ask that question. And we have received received a few hair samples now, along with a lot of selfies. But it's generally the male audience. Women just kind of have an idea of exactly what their hair type is. You also enter what your hair goals are. So if you want volume, anti-frizz, color protection, the fragrance you want, et cetera. So we customize every single bottle down to that.
Now, couldn't you just have, you know, a line of like 20 different versions or something like formulas? And that's the usual business model.
You're
hyper diversified, not infinitely diversified, right?
Absolutely. So actually, this is my second rodeo. My first was a beauty company where we did something very similar to that. We had a lineup of products, and some people now have hair quizzes that basically help you select which of these products to get.
Yeah.
But when we asked what it would take to make this product perfect, of the 50 people I asked, every single person says something slightly different. And you would think that, like, okay, it's slightly different. Maybe they, and you know, we had great reviews, et cetera, but it really did come down to it. Every single person we talked to would end up coming up with something slightly different. And so we have 12 billion different, like significantly different combinations that we offer. And to date, we haven't filled the same formulation twice. We've had, you know, the hundreds of thousands of formulations. So that's how many SKUs we would technically need so far, but obviously it keeps expanding every single day. So no, every single product really is very different just because of the sheer combinations of hair goals, fragrance preferences, hair types. It's really, really tough to do something even less than 1,000 SKUs, I would argue.
Yeah, that makes sense once you get into fragrance and personal preference and things like that. Yeah.
So many products out on the market right now, right? Like, yeah, you have 100,000 or a million different beauty products, and it's purely for that. Each one tries to nail it in a slightly different way. So yeah,
that's true. Well, I mean, this is where things are heading. I mean, with the advent of like 3D printing and a bunch of other tools, you know, a lot of people can do all sorts of things with their laptop that used to be a service that they bought elsewhere. Software can do a lot of things for us that we didn't know. So this hyper specialization seems to be where a lot of things are headed. People are printing shoes now and things like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you think is the smartest thing you ever did to achieve success in this business? Cause you've tell me a little bit about some of the success you've done. What have you achieved in this business?
So we're one of the fastest growing startups, well, ever, it's surprisingly interesting to know that it's in retail and CPG. So in an industry that generally takes a lot more lead time, takes a lot longer to go from idea to implementation to growth, just because of the traditional cost structure. So I think, mm-hmm. I think just how quickly we've been able to grow has been an awesome success. I think the talent we've been able to attract is phenomenal. And there's not too many MIT kids who end up going into beauty.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
But the company,
not a lot of programmers.
No, exactly. But the company that's able to attract such diverse talent. And obviously we have people from all walks of life that end up working here, but being able to get that diversity and that, the level of caliber is awesome. So it's really great that we've been able to get so many people to rally around this vision and this idea. So I think that would be the second thing. And then the third is just the sheer magnitude of being able to truly revolutionize an industry.
Just take on something that people think is impossible, and just having that goal is a smart thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. To the risk goes the rewards. Excellent. So what is the worst crisis you ever had, and how did you bounce back?
So probably the highest growth that we had was going into like our second or third month. So we're getting inundated by orders, something like, I don't know, 10 times what we expected. So we've got, we have a production facility out in Pennsylvania. So we have everybody, just these engineers, just trying to build these automated machines. So the idea is, after you actually do this hair quiz, we have a unique formulation. But we were, obviously our machines were meant to handle something like 10% of the capacity that we were starting to get. And then our key filling machine basically just broke, and was going to need about 3 weeks to fix, which sucks, because that's longer than obviously our lead time. Yeah. This is holiday season. It's Christmas.
Oh my God.
And so I had to basically individually email every single customer, me and my head of marketing, while our production side was just, trying to do as much as they could to make sure that we got obviously the perfect product, because the last thing we want to do is compromise a product.
Well, that's your total brand, is that your product is unlike anything else.
Exactly. So that production woe was probably one of the biggest crises that we had. So yeah.
Cool. All right. Looking back, if you had a time machine, you can go back in time and do one thing differently. Would you pick anything? What would it be?
That's a really good question.
I mean,
people always say that the flaw in doing that is you risk kind of losing what you currently have, right? Because one little change could...
You got to take the bad with the good. Yeah.
So I hate answering that question the way probably many people do, but I feel
bad for the person who does not have a problem answering it. Like there's like, yes, that one thing ruined my life and I haven't been able to come back from it yet. Like if that's a simple question for you, then I feel bad.
No, I mean, we made some poor hires, but at the end of the day, we ended up growing so much and making phenomenal hires as a result. And I would much rather have that as opposed to mediocre hires that you're just kind of okay with. Even our production issues, we ended up coming up with a much better system as a result of that.
So something breaks down, but you wouldn't have actually come up with this new thing unless you had the downside. Yeah,
exactly. So, and then when we came up with a new idea of how to automatically fill bottles, suddenly we were like, oh wow, we can grow this at 100 times more than we thought we could. Yeah. you know, we ended up halting our production and our marketing just to rebrand. And that's something that I thought I would end up regretting just because of how long it ended up taking. But it was a phenomenal success. And I think it really ended up making us who we are as a company. So even those things, I think, we're super happy with. So yeah, so not a thing.
No, that's great. It's like Nietzsche says, you know, your bliss is equal to your suffering, you know? So you don't wish for less suffering. You wish to be able to endure more. So
there you go.
Have more bliss. Yeah. All right. So as an entrepreneur, do you think your brain is any different from, you know, the average, you know, 9-to-5 or as an MIT entrepreneur, you know, do
sure.
you think differently? You know, you're going, I find so many times I talk to entrepreneurs, they go into an industry. Obviously beauty is full of entrepreneurs, but maybe it wasn't full of a lot of, you know, data oriented entrepreneurs. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So do you think differently than the average person, and that's an advantage.
So I don't think becoming an entrepreneur changed the way my brain worked. I think because of the way my brain worked, I ended up wanting to become an entrepreneur. I often say it's the only thing I really could do in many respects. While I love coding and math and science, I also really love design and all the creativity that kind of comes with entrepreneurship. And so I remember like taking a step back and thinking, you know, if I wasn't doing this, what would I be doing? And trust me, it's a scary question for years to come. And that's why everyone just assumes that I'll always kind of be in this space just because it's the only space where I can exercise every aspect of what I love to do and what I think I'm good at. And I think it's that the coming together of the creative and design side with the very technical know-how and operational engineering side, that being able to combine that all, you know, I think I'm very blessed to be able to find an industry and be able to excel at it. But I think
it makes sense.
I think as a result of that, entrepreneurship was kind of always my only real calling.
That makes sense. Yeah, no. And it's, I often say to people that I would either be self-employed or unemployed. I couldn't really, it's not like I have like some ego thing, you can't work for somebody else, but it was just a matter of just, you know, the passion of building your own ship. I'd work, you know, 80 hours, 90 hours a week on my own stuff to avoid working like 20 for someone else,
sure,
you know?
Sure. I do envy, every now and then I envy the 9-to-5 job,
yeah,
where it's like
you
don't have to stress or worry about stuff after the work day, and you know, you just kind of know what you're getting into in advance.
But you take the good with the bad, because they envy us, you know, they envy the bank account afterwards, I'm sure. After you pay your dues, of course, and after you work hard.
I feel like the general entrepreneur doesn't walk away with too much. So I think it's, you're super blessed if you can.
That's true.
So, yeah.
Well, there is a thing that if you stick it out long enough, you figure out the game. You know, like I've been doing this for like 20 years before I really reached what I would consider like just comfort, success, have more.
No, that's good. And not many people can hold on for 20 years, right? And I think that's like even going through Y Combinator, like we've seen horror stories, and even coming out of my class, like I've seen so many of my batchmates who, you know, have been doing this for 10, 15 years. And finally it's like, well, you know, they're getting a little older. They want to start a family. They want some stability, and they end up getting really awesome jobs that they really end up enjoying. But, you know, there's a limit to, I think, how long you can stick it out as well. And so oftentimes,
it's interesting. I talk to a lot of people, and this is why I like having these conversations, because the questions are just there to spark a conversation. But I talk to a lot of people, you know, from Silicon Valley, and it seems like it's a world in and of itself where there's almost like a formula to running a business, to having a startup. And when I started, there was no formula to running a business. Running a business was how to exit the formula. Like, you just make it up.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, when I started though, I actually feel a lot in common with software guys, because I was selling information. I have an informational product, an educational product. But just imagine being like a 21-year-old kid trying to teach somebody about it, an educational matter. There was a credibility issue being younger and going to like school saying, I can teach you how to teach. But eventually I did overcome that. I have a double blind neuroscience study that proves my method is superior and all that. But you know, that like those little things over time. But I think the difference was I was just self-employed. It was just my own ship. I didn't need an investor. I didn't need, you know, it would have been nice to have a mentor, but I basically just figured out how to create stuff and sell it myself. And then when I started to expand and I had employees and other things, then I think I had that base of surviving myself for so long that I could grow from. I find that the startup culture kind of goes in the other direction, where you get right out of college and you start, and you know, if you don't get $500,000 or $1 million in VC, yeah, then you're scum, you know what I mean? And I mean, when I started out, like $500 was a lot of money, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I figured out how to turn that $500 into hundreds of thousands and everything, and so that when I do get the, you know, the millions, or when I, in my case, when I got an infomercial, then I could leverage that to much greater level, because I had done a lot with very little. So I think it all depends on where you come from. But I do agree with you, though, that I think that there's a lot of people, Y Combinator is a great example, where, you know, they try out the entrepreneurial thing. It might not be right for them, but it's great experience for them to take into their job. And that's fantastic. But, you know, the ones who do slug it out and do take the risk, sometimes with family, sometimes without, very often, eventually you figure it out. You start one business that fails, you start another until you figure out how not to fail. And then, sure, you know, you've contributed to society, you've created jobs or something like that. So you've clearly, you know, done a great job right out of the bat. So you've handled a lot of crisis. And,
well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't the first rodeo. And you know, I was like 28 years old when I started Function of Beauty. So I was, you know, I definitely had a lot of time between graduation and ended up staying in school for a lot longer to figure out, you know, what it was that I was passionate about and what industries I really wanted to go into. But nonetheless, like, you know, it did take a while.
And it's not just you, though. You have mentors, you have other people that are supporting you.
Absolutely. And that was what was so great about Y Combinator. And obviously, you know, just the MIT alumni network, we have so many cool, awesome entrepreneurs or just professionals in general that you can lean on for advice. And then just the team that I have around me has been insanely, insanely great and pivotal in making us a success.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Okay. So here's a fun question. What do you have for breakfast?
I don't eat breakfast.
You fast?
I realized there's this intermittent fasting
trend
diet.
Yeah.
I did ketosis for a while. Today's my first day on this intermittent fasting. I think breakfast is the most overrated meal in the world.
Nice.
I finally found a diet that agrees with me. So that's helpful.
Cool. I've actually been doing intermittent fasting for about a year now.
How do you like it?
Yeah, I love it. It takes about 3 months before you really get used to it.
Okay.
There was a time where I had an injury and my doctor said that I had to eat more. So I had to stop it for a while for like 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
And it was really hard to get back into it afterwards because it was like my body was like, yes, calories, you know? But now you got to get used to one. I suggest people move the dial. So they, you know, just stop eating at like 9 o'clock at night. And get you to stop eating there.
I think there's a lot of people
that
do that. Exactly. Yeah.
But like do that and get really good at that. Then move that 10 in the morning to 11, you know, skip breakfast and then 12. And then I'm to around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when I'll eat. So I have this window between 4 and then 9 p.m. that I'll eat anything. Yeah. And I'm actually on a really strict thing. I'm trying to really get shredded for the summer here. So I'm losing about 2 pounds a week. So I'm going to stop it soon, but I'm on about
2 pounds a week. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. I was
it's
on
1500 calories a day.
Seeing if I can, you know, obviously
you
I'd like
to
eat
it,
more
though.
Things.
Your body's going to fight you. Like the cravings become intense. Your body fights you. That's why you don't do like extreme right away.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of weeks, then you go a little later and later.
Yeah, I'm eating from like 12, like 1 to 8 right now or 8:30 right now.
1 o'clock is a really good time. You just, you kind of work through lunch, let other people go to lunch, be a little practice patience in the Buddhist sense. And then you can just break your fast, have something light. And then when you go home, have something to eat. It's been fantastic. But I will say, though, I do something for breakfast. I have coffee. I also make like a bottle of tea every day that I drink.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
drinking water and coffee a lot more in the mornings as a result of this. So I'm with you there.
That fills up. I have a vitamin and fish oil in the morning, you know, so like you still have something, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Good time to work out is first thing in the morning. But yes, changed my life. I actually was on Fox Superhuman, and I look at that and I'm like, I weighed probably 30 pounds of fat more then. Oh, wow, okay. And I look so big.
Yeah,
and, if anybody can see a picture, if you look at that, I look much bigger. And like that, all the intermittent fasting since then, took me about 6 months, and I just like trimmed down to nothing. It was
that's great. Awesome. Do you watch what you eat when you do eat, or are you a little?
Well, only now like because I'm counting the calories, 1500 calories. If I don't watch, then if I look back, I do about 2000, which for my weight, I weigh about 200 pounds is perfectly fine. Okay. But now I'm trying to do 1500. So I got to be more selective, but it's amazing how quickly you get used to it, and you have a salad, a meal. Have like a Subway sandwich, and that's not to advertise or anything, but I'm not Jared. Well, but you're looking at that and it's like 600 calories. It's like, okay, so I got another 800 calories for the rest of the day. I could have like some chocolate for 100 calories, 200 calories. And then I got, have something else, a sandwich at night. And then I just practice patience and just wait till the next time and keep busy. It makes you work harder.
That's cool.
Put in a lot more hours. So yeah, right there with you. It's one of the reasons why I asked the question, because I'm kind of like, talking about it.
All these life hackers.
Breakfast was kind of invented by a PR guy anyways. all right. So what do you find is, I'm not going to ask you the manage and motivate question, but I wanted to ask you, because I think there's probably an answer for this. Tell me something that is unexpected about you or your company.
I mean, I think one thing is that it's not like a marketing hoax, if that makes sense. Like I think a lot of people still just assume we have this handful of products, like 100 products that we end up bucketing people into. But I think
you think it's like they think it's a trick and it's not
correct.
So I think machines that pump a different amount of each.
Yeah, like I think people underestimate just how crazy cool our production line is, if that makes sense.
You should really promote that.
Like, I know we've been like, expanding into another. Every time we like think we like it looks good and cool, we've been asked to be on like How It's Made and stuff. But I don't know, just from an IP protection standpoint,
you don't have to do How It's Made. That actually doesn't have as huge a following because they don't always get to promote the actual business, like in terms of like in terms of return on your investment. But you could get just online media would be really interested in the process,
No, it's true. And
you could protect whatever you want to protect. You don't have to show them everything. But
no, absolutely.
Why you go through a PR company. No, but that's why you go through people and you figure out what it is you're willing to share, what it is you're not. You give a few secrets up, but in return, you get all of this press and so
that's why we're doing a showroom in Soho. So we're combining our new lab and showroom together so that, members of the press, influencers, just some of our close ambassadors can basically come and watch how it's actually made. So that'll be pretty exciting. It's not on the scale of production.
When's that going to launch?
Soon. We're building it out now.
Okay. So, I hope you have like the press releases ready and you're telling the media
because we'll definitely be on top of that.
All right. Cool. That's something that, like the behind the scenes and everything, and especially if it's some sort of challenge, like, are these guys really doing what they say they'll do? I'm going to find out news at 11 type thing.
Exactly. And so that's
attitude.
You only have, a certain number of sound bites that you can use up to basically share the idea, the solution, mm-hmm. etc. And so I think people don't expect us to be as like, I think especially when you look at the branding and all of that, I don't think too much of the engineering and crazy science technology comes out and for intentional reasons. Like we want to make it a brand with a lot of personality, one that speaks to every customer, individually. And so
your fundamental selling feature is that customization, though. I think that's one of the reasons why I really like PR, but a lot of people think of PR as, I got this hit in the Wall Street Journal, so I should get these many sales from it. And they don't realize that it's more third party validation.
Sure. Absolutely.
If you're buying a bunch of ads on Facebook and you've got, the New York Times saying that your process is actually unique, then those ads on Facebook are worth more. Like everything afterwards becomes worth more. And I think that's a big mistake people make with PR is they try to see PR just like advertising. They don't realize when you turn it into more of a third party credential, a social proof, then you really make money from it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I could see someone doing like a challenge, like a 60-minute challenge where they put, you know, your formulations through like a mass spectrometer to see if it really has the percentages that you say you put in there and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be fun. All right. Yeah. Okay, so right now, what I like to ask though is your marketing hook. I think that your main marketing hook is super customization, but what are your marketing plans going forward? It's kind of the last question so you can elaborate and tell people how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, I mean, so we obviously, social media is particularly helpful for us. I think it's the first time people actually take a picture of their bottles of shampoo and conditioner, right, and share it just because we do a cool way of digitally printing their name on the bottle. So it's,
you put like the volumes of each different ingredients and stuff or like
we without we the do a, yeah, we don't give the exact, you know, percentages, but we do use a legitimate label, which, you know, lists the ingredients in order of their percentages.
Okay.
But anyway, so that's kind of cool, is just to see all the user generated content that we've been able to develop. And so social media will always be kind of our bread and butter. So Facebook and Instagram right now, we're just getting on to Snapchat, which has been super awesome.
I can see that because yours like hyper customized. So you could be, not every business can really use Snapchat, but you could.
Exactly. Yeah. And our customers are by far, like most of our sales still happen through organic channels. So it's somebody who receives a set. You know, it's like function of day. Oh, this is really cool. I'm going to take a picture of this.
What about going to influencers? It would sound like you'd want to get a hold of all the influencers, bloggers, YouTubers.
Yeah. So a lot of influencers do end up reaching out to us. You know, we don't pay any influencers.
That's earned media. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we do want to make sure that everything is super organic and at least fair that way. So we get honest reviews across the board. So we do have influencers who will reach out to us saying like, hey, you know, we'd love to get a set in order to, you know, promote it. If you know, obviously the big caveat is, you know, they like it. And I was like, if you don't, just let us know, cause we'd love to get feedback. So influencers are obviously a big angle as well. And again, that's still social media. We're getting onto YouTube, trying to get more of a video presence as well, which is something that we're working on. But anyway, so that for the most part is our really, you know, big value add. We do some email campaigns with like hair tips and other cool things that really align with our brand. You know, once a month, nothing intense. We're doing a cool section on our site called Hair Lab, where we're trying to do like a personalized blog, whereby, you know, based on your hair type, your hair goals, your preferences, we can start feeding you articles that are very pertinent.
I feel like I need a haircut now.
Or grow it out. That's what I did.
I wish I do not look good with hair grown out. I love it, but my hair gets really greasy. Listen, I probably know more about my hair.
You know, you just need a personalized set, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know what? I would listen, if we could do something, I would be happy to blog about the result. I actually have problems with my scalp. I don't have any shame in talking about it, but I have vitiligo. A few people might notice two tones in my skin. I'm one of those guys, not ashamed at all. It's just a real thing.
Sure.
But because of that, my immune system doesn't like some of my skin.
Okay.
So it goes after my scalp, and I have zero history of we should have been talking about this earlier, but I have zero history of hair loss in my family. My hair is very solid, very strong, but I do have a very flaky scalp.
Yeah, yeah.
But I tried all of the flaky scalp stuff. It just makes it worse because it's not caused by bacteria.
Sure.
It's caused by autoimmune. Yeah. So the stuff that has worked for me has been tea tree oil, anything that's more soothing to the scalp, honey-based stuff. What would you recommend?
So we do have an essential oils blend, which has tea tree, eucalyptus, some oils that do really well for the scalp. And we do have a cool soothe scalp hair goal that actually focuses on treating irritated scalps. Obviously, like oil control and all of that is obviously a big thing too. So there are actually some hair goals that we do offer. We can't obviously make any medical claims or even argue that we can, you know, solve.
Yeah, no, I understand. Conditions. We'll tell you what. Could I, if you guys send me a bottle?
Yeah, we'll send you a gift set. You can
appreciate that.
You can select your hair goals. You can chat with our chemist as well if you have any questions.
I will do it. I will do it for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And I will do a video about the results. We're going to tag it to this one.
All right.
And I will be honest about my challenges. Anybody who has like an autoimmune skin condition. Psoriasis, things like that. It's something like 5% of the population. Like it's a lot of people living in I try to be open about it because there's a lot of people who have agoraphobia because they don't want to leave the house. I was giving a talk. I'm a public speaker. I speak at colleges all the time. And there was this one guy who kept on taking pictures of me every time I put my hands up. It was almost like a, and it's because of the vitiligo. His dad has vitiligo and like apparently hasn't left the house for a year because he has some of it on his neck and he's afraid that people will think he has a contagious disease. So, but there's a great model actually has vitiligo that's just gorgeous and she's breaking down some of the barriers about that. This is one of those things that people with psoriasis and things like that, you see a little flaky skin and you think, oh, it's gross or something. And people if you could do something about that, if there's a formulation, you've got a whole market there.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Yeah.
I'll be honest about it. I'll video it and everything. Yeah. Send this over and we'll do it up. That'd be great.
That sounds awesome.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being on the show. You are
definitely brains behind it.
This is brilliant. What happens when an MIT grad decides to go to beauty school? That's the thing. That is the question. This is the answer. This is the future of beauty, I think. I guess this won't be the end. This will be a continuation. This will be part one of our whole thing. So, but thank you very much for being on the Brains Behind
It. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.